You're listening to Beetroot Radio, community radio for Rushton and the Nen Valley.
And this is Andy Yates, and this is the Andy Wise Show. And looking forward to you, my listener, opening that little door in your mind and picking up on some of the good stuff we're going to do here. Today, we're going to be talking about some things. Overpopulation is going to be the main subject. Really, what that's all about, where it all fits together, how it affects us. And some of the stats that you may not know. I've also put some stuff in there to make it a lot of fun because I appreciate the statistics can be kind of boring. So we don't want to do that. But, there's all kinds of interesting things in there. And gosh, overpopulation is such a wonderful media or palette to paint pictures of conspiracy theory, you bet your life. Now, I've used the title overpopulation because it's a question. Are we overpopulated? Are we not? And some of the fun statistics I'm going to present are going to give you some idea on that. And we're going to do a sort of an introduction into this and talk about some issues around the subject. So overpopulation is something that's been around for a long time, and population control, or the control of what the population's made up of, has been around for a long time. I mean, we all know that the Nazis had their ideas of what the population should, be, and they wanted to create the perfect Aryan man and all this stuff, which is kind of interesting because the perfect Aryan man, I always thought, was the tall blonde guy, and yet sure, Hitler was a little short, dark-haired guy, but never mind. But around that time, there a popular movement that was going on was the eugenicists. And the eugenicists were those people who thought the population should be controlled in the sense that the human race should be strengthened or whatever. And no doubt, they thought that they were part of that strengthening, because they were smart and clever, and that their blood should be added into that stream and other people's blood taken out. It was a pretty horrible thing, actually. But one of them, a famous one, a British guy called Sir Julian Huxley, who, as I said, was a British eugenicist, wrote an essay called The Crowded World, which was published in 1964. And he was critical of communist and Catholic attitudes to birth control, population control, and overpopulation. And he worked out, based on the principles of compound interest. So compound interest being for example, if you put some money away and you got 5% interest, this year you'd get simple interest, 5% interest of the money you put away. Next year you get 5% interest of the money that's in the account, which is the money you put away plus the interest you learned last year. So that's the way compound interest worked. But he predicted that, and this is in 1964, he predicted there would be a probable world population of 6 billion by the year 2000. And in actual fact, the United Nations Population Fund marked the 12th of October 1999 as the day of 6 billion. So this guy was like 2 months out. So some people knew what they were talking about when they had ideas of how the population would grow. Sir Julian Huxley, as I said, British eugenicist, he argued for quality over quantity about the world's population, and that the human population size should be planned and controlled. So he had ideas of breeding certain races and not breeding other certain races, or breeding certain types of people and not other types of people, and all of that. So eugenicism was quite popular, but of course, in the end, people went for a much more humanitarian approach, which I personally think is the way to go. Because overpopulation is often, it's the elephant in the room. It's the 400-pound gorilla in the corner that people don't want to talk about. Because really, immediately when you talk about overpopulation, that sounds like we need some kind of a reduction of population. And then the instantaneous emotional reaction, well, what are you going to do, kill a load of people? obviously, that doesn't work in our world where most of us care about our fellow human beings. So I think it's important to come up with a humanitarian solution. And this is the key, the crux and all this kind of thing. I mean, we've seen disease which doesn't change the population at all. At one time, they thought things like Ebola or even AIDS would be the thing that would kind of level and bring down the population. Well, it didn't, because, of course, there are advances in medicine and medical science and stuff like that, plus perhaps some changes in social habits, or at least taking precautions, if you know what I'm talking about. And those kind of actions then reduced the impact of such a deadly disease. But it's kind of interesting when you look at this subject. Now, let me give you something that's kind of interesting if you didn't already know about it. In June 1979, a man using the pseudonym Robert C. Christian, so R.C. Christian, for whatever that's worth, he went to the Elberton Granite Finishing Company on behalf of a small group of loyal Americans and commissioned a thing called the Georgia Guidestones. And this is a granite monument erected in 1980 in Elbert County, Georgia, in the United States. Now, the idea of it is that it's like it's got one slab standing in the center with four slabs arranged around it. So if you could imagine, if you looked at it from the top, it would look like a cross. It has a capstone on top of that, similar to the capstones that you'd kind of that look you'd see at Stonehenge. And these five slabs are astronomically aligned. So there's an additional stone tablet set in the ground a short distance to the west of the structure, which provides some notes on the history and purpose of the Guidestones. Now, what's important is this is still unknown who put this up and for what purpose. It's kind of interesting. The structure is sometimes referred to as the American Stonehenge. It's 19 feet 3 inches tall, so it's big. It's made of granite, six granite slabs, and altogether they weigh something like 237,000 pounds. Which is 107,000 kilograms in all. And there's lots of writing on it, and there's lots of different things on it, and it's in many, many languages. I think it's in Sanskrit. It's in some other Babylonian writing. Obviously, it's in English as well. There's different translations and so on, which is kind of interesting, as nobody knows for sure. Well, I say nobody. Most people don't know for sure who actually put this thing up and what is its exact purpose. But there are a set of 10 guidelines on the Georgia Guidestone. And let me read three of them to you that are related to population. And if you want to see all 10, we'll go out on the web, put in Georgia Guidestones, and I'm sure you'll find it. And these are not in any particular order. Maintain humanity under 500 million in perpetual balance with nature. And we know we have probably 7.6 billion right now. So maintain humanity under 500 million in perpetual balance with nature. Guide reproduction wisely, improving fitness and diversity. And that's a little bit of that eugenicist stuff coming through. And then another one would be not a cancer on the earth, leave room for nature. And that's repeated, leave room for nature. So that's on the Georgia Guidestone. So this is something that people are thinking important. I mean, it must have cost a lot of money to put that stuff up. Of course, there are people in the world who have lots of money. But it's kind of interesting that people would go to that trouble to kind of bring to our attention the idea of that kind of overpopulation being an issue. And I'm going to play a bit of music now, and then we'll look into some quotes from some famous people, because now we're starting to really get into this. And then we'll start speeding up, because as usual, I want to make sure I get all of this in because you do want to know about life on Mars and the alien octopi, I'm sure.
This is Beetroot Radio.
Okay, so let's look at some quotes about overpopulation or population itself. I'll give you the quote and I'll tell you who it was. First, we got, this is a quote. First, we got population now today has 6.8 million people. This is in 2010. That's headed up to about 9 billion. Now, listen to this. Now, if we do a really great job on new vaccines, healthcare, reproductive health services, we lower that by perhaps 10 or 15%. And that was Bill Gates, obviously Microsoft. And the thing that's interesting, and conspiracy theorists love this one, is it says, now, if we do a really great job on new vaccines, miss out the next bit, we lower the population. And a lot of people jumped all over that and said, what does that mean? Because, of course, you know that Bill Gates has had some problems with some of the vaccines he supplied to other third world countries, and that they've actually caused more good than more bad than good, should I say. So anyway, that's kind of interesting. Another quote. A total population of 250 to 300 million people, a 95% decline from present levels would be ideal. And this is from Ted Turner, who, of course, is the, or was at least the owner of CNN. Interesting. And here's one you'll love. I'm going to tell you where it was first. This is from Prince Philip. And it's from his foreword to his book, If I Were an Animal, which is United Kingdom, Robert Clark Limited, 1986. Quote, I just wonder what it would be like to be reincarnated in an animal whose species has been so reduced in numbers that it was in danger of extinction. What would be its feelings towards the human species whose population explosion had denied it somewhere to exist? I must confess that I am tempted to ask for reincarnation as a particularly deadly virus. Now that's interesting, isn't it? And, I mean, I suppose it could have been well meant, but I mean, kind of what's being talked about there is killing a bunch of people, which is not my idea of a humanitarian approach. And there was another one from Prince Philip, because they said these are all around the web. And this one was kind of interesting because it's interesting how so many of the debunker sites that say, oh, we've debunked this and all this kind of thing. And the debunker sites on this one say, well, it's obviously I've debunked it because I can't find it anywhere on the web. So it's debunked. And it's like, shut up. That is not debunking. Debunking is finding scientific or other evidence that proves that what was said, the theory or conspiracy theory, was incorrect. Just saying it can't find it on the web could be your ineptitude as to searching things out on the web, because I found a couple of debunking sites that said exactly that about this next quote that's coming, which was in fact reported by Deutsche Presse Agentur, DPA, in August 1988. And there are German press association, just like a UK might have a press association like Reuters, right? And it says, quote, in the event that I am reincarnated, I would like to return as a deadly virus in order to contribute something to solve overpopulation. So Prince Philip said that more than twice. He's got this idea in his head that that would be an okay thing to do, to come back as a virus and kill a bunch of people. I mean, did he really mean that? Of course he did. What else does he mean? But I don't know, maybe from his position, that seems a good thing to do. I get the feeling that the virus wouldn't work on people with blue blood. I just get that feeling. But anyway, so that's what that is. So you can see that lots of famous people have certainly had some very strong views about this. And a lot of people think that the population should be reduced. And there's a certain logic to that, isn't there? To be fair, there's a certain logic. I mean, if I have 10 resources and 5 people, if I spread it fairly, everybody gets 2 each. If I have 10 resources and only 2 people, everybody gets 5 each if I spread it evenly. The simple fact is, in this world nowadays, if I had 10 resources and 5 people, 4 people would get 1 and 1 would get 6. That's the way it is in this world, but there you go. So I got another example here now, just to try and give a sort of an analogy around this issue of population or overpopulation. Now, the UK, as we know, is a great animal lover nation, which means that over half the households in the UK own a pet. And I'm not talking about the wife or the husband. I'm talking about a pet, so a pet animal, right? And I'm still not talking about the wife or the husband. Okay, so here's some facts. We have a great number of stray dogs in the UK that the local authorities collect. And they've collected over, they collect kind of about 100,000 dogs each year. I'm a dog lover. I've got 2 dogs that are rescued dogs. I like dogs. There it is. In the UK, local authorities keep each unclaimed dog available for adoption for 7 days. If it's not adopted or transferred to a private animal welfare organisation, the dog is put to sleep, even if it's fit and healthy. That's pretty horrid, isn't it, when you think of that? Although, private animal welfare organisations, charities that is, often will take the dogs away. I know my big dog, she was on a kill list in the United States. Same sort of thing. Taken away by the authorities and was countdown towards being put down, even though she was young, big, healthy. But then she was rescued by a no-kill centre who rescued her and then put up for adoption, and then we adopted her. Now, this is kind of sad because some statistics here. Dogs obtained from breeders, 40.75%. So people are going to breeders for dogs, and there are some very popular dogs because of their breed, because they're trendy, because they're nice dogs. I don't blame anybody for doing that, but I would have always gone to a shelter or a rescue place first to see if I can find any of those dogs or anything close to that dog before I'd go to a breeder. Some of the breeders, certainly not all, but some of the breeders aren't very nice to their animals. They're their job, that's what they sell, and they keep the dogs for breeding and don't really care about them. So there you go. But okay, 40.75% for breeders, 28.42% go to shelters, so that's non-local authority, 1.37% local authorities, and these are dogs obtained from, so this is where people get their dogs from, right? 25.68% from a friend, 2.4% from the internet. That's, I suppose that's all right. I'm just thinking of a Amazon package arriving with a puppy in it. That's horrible and scary, isn't it? 7.19 from classified ad and 5.56 other, whatever that means. But I swear I looked at these statistics. So let me just go through that again. A couple of points. 40.75 from breeders. 1.37 from the local authority. Now, it may be that the local authority doesn't have any dogs worth adopting. But remember, these dogs I'm talking about here are ones that are suitable for adoption. So they're not vicious, they're not diseased or anything like this. They're not on their last legs. In other words, a very old dog. We're actually talking about something, you know, that there's a dog that would be suitable for adoption. So I'm kind of thinking, well, why is it that the local authorities only have 1.37%? And that shows that they ain't making much effort to me to make people know that they've got these dogs that they're selling. It. You can go online, you can see plenty of charities and other things like this that that have dogs for adoption, like the RSPCA. There's a big one, right? But if you go to your local authority, what websites you're seeing, how is that being sold? It's very little effort, and it seems less effort to actually keep the dog for 7 days and euthanize it, which is pretty horrid. Anyway, but here's the thing. I mean, if you look at it that way and talk about this difference between breeders or getting it from a shelter or a local authority, I've used the example of a Labradoodle. Because there are some popular breeds around. I met a Cockapoo the other day, which is a Cocker Spaniel Poodle cross. A Labradoodle is a Labrador Poodle cross. What we've got at home is a Labradane, which is a Labrador Great Dane cross. That's the big girl. But she was rescued from a kill centre. Anyway, I did a quick survey on the web. And if you were to adopt a Labradoodle from a breeder, it would cost you around 850 to 1,000 quid. If you went to a rescue centre, and I found Labradoodles at rescue centres, not many, I must be honest, because it's a popular dog, but I did find some, it would cost you 100 to 130 quid. So there's something going wrong there, I'm just saying, all right? Over 7% of local authorities' intake of dog is put to sleep each year. 7% of those 100,000 dogs. That's 7,000 dogs, isn't it? And about 20 dogs are put down every day. That's awfully sad. That's awfully sad when really just new to your dog, for God's sake, you know. Unless you want to breed it, and that's fine if you know you can move on the puppies and everything. You know, in a healthy kind of animal welfare way. But if you're not going to, neuter your dog. Anyway, a high percentage of people support dog licensing and the practice of neutering and spaying. That's just what I'm talking about. But dog licensing in the UK was abolished in 1987. And the dog license cost 37 pence. I know it's a problem because obviously, if you've got dog licensing, then you'd have to police that. And we've already talked on this show before about how much of a problem that would be. It wouldn't be the police, but how much it would be a problem to employ people to check people's dogs to see if they have licenses. How would they do that? There'd be punch-ups in the street and all this kind of thing. So maybe not such a good thing. But in 2016, it was mandatory to have microchips in a dog. And that cost 10 to 15 quid. So I would certainly highly recommend that so your dog could be brought back to you. That doesn't solve the problem of all strays, but you can see what I mean. The population is too high. If local authorities are pulling in 100,000 dogs a year, then the population's too high. And the solution seems to be licensing and neutering and spaying. Can we do that to the human population? No, I don't think so. Well, not just like that. But let's go on a bit and we'll talk about this a little bit more. And we need to have a look perhaps at the overpopulation causes. Overpopulation is caused by a number of factors. You might say this could be reduced mortality rate. So less people die because medical science is better. We live better, certainly in this country. I won't say we live a healthier diet, but we generally don't starve. There are people in this country who do. But generally speaking, we get enough to eat. I said better medical facilities. But one of the other causes is the lack of access to contraception. We're going to talk about that a little bit more. Through this, I'm going to state some statistics. And there's a wonderful, wonderful guy who sadly died last year. His name is Hans Rosling. He's Swedish. And he's a statistician. And he presents statistics, particularly about different things, but about finance and stuff like that. But he does do a whole one-hour talk on the human population. And he presents it in a very engaging, interesting way. So don't be put off by the fact he's a statistician. He's actually very funny. he's actually, you know, sadly, he's not with us anymore. Died last year of prostate cancer, I think. But his family has continued his work. And there is a website, www.gapminder.com. You'll remember that because it's Mind the Gap, as you would get in the underground, right? www.gapminder.com. And his name is Hans Rosling. You can also find him on TED Talks. Because TED Talks, if you didn't know, are a very useful subject for a summary of situations. TED Talks, oh gosh, what does TED stand for? Technology, Education and Drama, don't know. But TED, T-E-D, Talks. And they do, generally speaking, an 18-minute presentation. So it's not boring because it's only 18 minutes long. They compress lots of facts and wonderful presentations into those kind of things. So if there are things you are interested in and you wanted to do some research, good idea to start with TED Talks. There you go. But anyway, so a lot of his statistics, a lot of my statistics come from Hans Rosling, which is why I'm giving some props. The population is still growing. 7.5 billion, 6 billion, 7.6 billion people right now. Here's some interesting things. In 10,000 BC, so 12,000 years ago, there were 10 million people on the planet. 10 million. Million. Not billion. Million. In the year 1800 AD, there was 1 billion. And then we hit the Industrial Revolution. In 1960 AD, 3 billion. So it took 160 years to put on 2 billion people. But from 1960 to obviously current date, 2018, we've put on the difference 4.5 billion people. And it's still growing. And remember, the life of the Earth, that's going to go on for at least 1.75 billion years. So the Earth isn't going to be affected by the effects of overpopulation. It will just reset and start again. But the human race, well, that may be affected greatly. The UK population, the current population of the United Kingdom is 66,550,939. 42. I'm messing about. And that's as of Monday, June 11th, 2018. So this month, week ago or so, a couple of weeks. And that's based on the latest United Nations estimates. Now, in 1955, it was 51 million. Now, our country is a bit odd that way because we've always had a fairly high population because we've been around a long time. We've been a cosmopolitan city where people have come to from all over the world. But we're still growing. The United Kingdom population is the equivalent of 0.87% of the world population. So not even 1%. But in, and I'm going to relate a couple of these statistics to the year 1955. So, but in 1955, the population of the United Kingdom was 1.84%. of the population of the world. So from 0.87 to 1.84. The UK ranks number 21 in the list of countries and dependencies by population. In 1955, it was ninth to the 21st. So obviously we're getting smaller in relation to other countries, even though we're growing. The population density in the United Kingdom, because I believe we are the most densely populated country in Europe, the population density in the United Kingdom is 275 per square kilometre. In 1955, it was 211. So we had more space in 1955, not surprisingly. The total land area is 241,000 kilometres squared, if you're interested. Now, 81.2% of the population is urban. That means live in towns, cities. because obviously suburban is on the edges of towns and cities, and then there's rural, which is in the country. In 1995, that was 78.8. So people are basically moving into the cities. The median age in the United Kingdom is 40.3 years old. In 1955, it was 35.1 years. So it's gone from 35.1 years old to 40.5 years. 40.3 years, I'm sorry. From 1995. So you can see that the average age in the UK is going upwards. Quite a lot, actually. And this is part of the problem. But the fertility rate in the United Kingdom has actually dropped down to 1.88 from 2.18 in 1955. It's dropped 0.3%. It's actually, and they say the sustainable population, the stability for the population is 2.1. So we are actually now have a fertility rate which is less than what we need to keep the population stable. And I kind of asked myself the question, you know, well, why are we increasing then? Okay, we are increasing at a rate of 1.88, but what we're basically saying is people are dying at a rate of, I don't know, 2.1. But then I found out a statistic, and you can assume or decide what you think about this yourselves. I'll just state the facts. 180,000 is the estimate for 2018 from immigration, which is almost half the yearly increase of 390,000. So mathematically speaking, without opinions, if we didn't have any immigrants, the population of the UK would fall. There you go. I'll leave it up to you to decide whether you think that's a good or a bad thing or something. Now, what are the reasons for the increase of this population? Well, there's a decline in the death rate, as I said, that, you know, because the population depends on the imbalance between the death rate and the birth rate. Because there are better medical facilities, the Industrial Revolution provided technological advancements, so science was able to produce better means of producing food. Medical science have improved to deal with many diseases, new medicines, new vaccines. In the old days, big families were necessary. There were big families. So big families need to overcome poverty because poverty tends to lead to large families to make up for a high infant mortality. Higher fertility. Technologies in medical science has led to higher conception rates, improved fertility and higher birth survival. You'll see kids that were born that are premature, preemies they call them, premature, that would not have survived 20 years ago. Nowadays they do survive. It's a good thing. Somebody's kids, you know, it's a good thing. But, again, it's increasing the rate. Immigration. Let's hit it. People move to develop countries with more facilities like the US, the UK, Canada, Australia, where there are the best facilities available for things like medical, education, security, and employment. So that's going to happen. There is always going to be the financial migrant as distinct from the refugee. Lack of family planning. Well, most developing nations have many illiterate people who often have children at an early age and have little or no knowledge about family planning. And I guess if you haven't got a TV, what else is there to do at night? Anyway, I'm sort of kidding, but this is the important thing. Better medical, the increase in populations caused by better medical facilities, bigger families to overcome a population, higher fertility, immigration, and lack of family planning. And gosh, bless his cotton socks. In May, President Trump proposed new restrictions on federally funded family planning by barring doctors from advising a woman pondering an abortion about where she could receive one. So doctors were not allowed to advise on abortion. Basically, they were given advice on how to have the baby. Now, I don't know whether you're pro-life or pro-choice, but the point is, it's legislation that's taking away that choice. And the fear of that proposal is it's a revival of the domestic gag rule first proposed by President Reagan, which would ban referral for abortion. So it would require that pregnant patients be referred for prenatal service and other care related to delivery, regardless of their wishes. Not sure about that. So again, President Trump is pandering to his evangelical voters, and who knows what he believes. That's politics. That's the way that happens. So American patients would no longer receive non-directive counselling. Yeah, it's that kind of thing that affects population. Now, population in America might be okay because I think their population's dropping as well, apart from immigration. So what are the problems of overpopulation? I mean, is this such a bad thing? Well, yes. There's the depletion of natural resources. Earth can only last a limited amount of time because in support of the human population, because there's only a limited amount of water and food. Most of the environmental damage in the last 50 years is because of the growing number of people on the planet. If they're not eating it, they're cutting down to cook the food, cutting down forests to cook their food, or cutting down forests to grow other kinds of food. Hunting wildlife in a reckless manner, causing pollution. It appears that overpopulation leads to acts of violence and aggression outside war zones because of competition for resources. And this is going to become more and more, and one of the big ones there is going to be water. Because there is only a fixed amount of water on this planet. We don't lose it, but if there are more people, they are going to consume more water and take it out of the natural system. There's also one of the problems of overpopulation is the degradation of the environment. The massive use of coal, oil, and natural gas has a serious effect on the environment. The rise in vehicles and industries, which are part of the industrial revolution that has kind of helped mankind increase, have affected the air quality. The rise in greenhouse gas emissions creates or increases global warming, leading to the melting of polar ice caps, changing climate patterns, and the rise in the sea level. So the rise in the sea level means there's going to be less land for the overpopulated Earth to live. Although there's plenty of land, the problem is does that land have the resources to support an increasing population? Does it have water? Does it have food? Does it have natural resources? Now, some countries decided to come out with some pretty hard solutions to this. And the one people talked about is China. Now, there are some things about China's solution that you probably didn't know. I know I didn't. Not that it makes it a good thing, because I don't think it was. But there are some things that you may not know. Let's talk about that. So China had a one-child policy. It was introduced in 1979, but it only affected the Han race. You may not realize that the Chinese has over 50 races. If you ever happen to be in Tiananmen Square one day, if you look towards the Forbidden City, to your right, you will see a row of flags. Those flags, every one represents a different Chinese race. So I guess that might be the Han race, the Siberians, the Mongolians, and so on and so on and so on. The different races that make up the whole of the Chinese people. So it was only the Han race, but of course the Han race was probably 90% of the Chinese race, but nevertheless, it only affected them. So the policy allowed for exceptions for many groups, including ethnic minorities. And that's what we're talking about there. They actually wanted them to increase. In 2017, 36% of China's population was subject to the one-child restriction. So not the whole thing, 36%. With an additional 53% being allowed to have a second child if the first child was a girl. So there were some of these changes. Nevertheless, it was enforced on the people, which I think most people would say was wrong, but there you go. And what would happen if you didn't follow the rules is you would be fined. The local and national governments, provincial governments would carry out fines and detection, and the local and national governments raised awareness and carried out registration and inspection work. Well, a lot of people would say that was wrong, having to register so you could have a child. Don't know. That might be coming down the pipe. So according to the Chinese government, 400 million births were prevented, although some people dispute this claim. But if that's the case, when you consider how many Chinese there are now, and I think that's 1.5 billion, stopping 400 million births was a good thing as far as population concerned, not a good thing as far as human and civil rights. I get it. But when you compare this policy to other countries with similar socio-economic development, like Thailand and Iran and India, and in India, the states of Kerala and Tamil Nadu, they achieved similar declines in fertility, but they didn't have a one-child policy. Although India doesn't get away with it, but I'll talk about that in a minute. 76% of the Chinese people supported the policy in a 2008 survey. Now, you're going to say, well, was that a fair survey? Were they allowed to vote freely? Because China's still a kind of communist country. Maybe, maybe not. But it does give an indication that the people weren't that much against it. But of course, it was controversial outside China, and there are some people who would always try and pick fault with China. In 2015, it was reported that the existing law, the one-child policy, would be changed to a two-child policy. And in fact, this new law became effective on January the 1st, 2016. And again, there were still exceptions to that law. People could apply if they had apply to have further children if they had exceptional circumstances, etc., etc. So they kind of backed off in that. Now, they tried something along the same lines, well, population control in India, because as you know, India's got a massive population. They're over a billion now. India's first census counted 356 million people in 1951, one-seventh of the world's population. And part of the problem was nearly 9 million Indian children had married before the age of 14. Now, we in the Western world would say that was wrong. And in 1951, the population was projected to grow by 500,000 per year, 500,000 per year. So a decision was made by the Indian politicians, government, whatever, to sterilize anyone with three or more children. That's pretty draconian. Some might say, well, at least you'll stop this runaway increase of population, but it's still draconian. And again, we're back to human and civil rights. Now, sterilization seemed simple, safe, cheap, and effective. There's a guy, M.C. Chagla, a former ambassador to the U.S., said, quote, "Until we develop an oral contraceptive that works and that we can afford, we must encourage sterilization. It must be voluntary." Okay. But in 1976, politicians changed the policy because what they were doing at the time was giving transistor radios to men who submitted to have vasectomies. and they changed the policy to compulsory sterilization. In other words, it wasn't voluntary anymore. And the police literally dragged people in from the fields to the vasectomy table, one medical officer told the New York Times. And we all trust the New York Times, right? However, it sounds like they've had some pretty draconian methods of enforcing this idea and carrying out compulsory sterilization. In all, more than 6 million people were sterilized that year. And the effect of it was causing violent protests. Because remember, India's a democracy. So there were violent protests, and what that did was stalled the measures to reduce the rate for decades. Decades, yes. And the population is now heading towards 1.5 billion people. It's kind of interesting how that works out, but there you go. However, my friend Hans Rolling, you remember the guy I told you about that died last year of prostate cancer? The statistician, www.gapminder.com. Here's some of the statistics he came out with. 1963, 5 babies per woman globally. In 2013, 2.5 babies per woman. Wow. In 50 years, an incredible decrease in the amount of babies per woman. Still too high to reduce the population, 2.5, but basically it came down. I think mainly pushed by the falling fertility rates in westernized countries like the UK, the US, and so on, and Europe. Two-child families are most common in, and this will surprise you, Bangladesh, Brazil, Vietnam, and India. Yes. So India got down to having commonly 2-child families without, once they got rid of, enforced sterilization. So that gives you a clue. Why was that? Maybe it's this education. We'll talk about this in a moment. In the 1800s, you had 6-child families, but 4 of them, on average, died. In 1960, you had 5-child families, but only 1 of them died. So you can see how it's changing. This guy, Rosling, considers that there would be a slowing down of growth in the year 2100, so in 82 years' time. Nevertheless, we would have 11 billion people because of falling child mortality. But the number of children would not increase from about the year 2000. So there would be 2 billion children, and that would stay the same. And if you think about it, when you had periods of time where adults were produced from, when they were children, there was a higher fertility rate, so there's more adults, 20 to 40, 40 to 60, 60 to 80, right? And obviously the 60 to 80s aren't dying off as much, but when they do die off, the reduced rate the reduced rate of children being produced would still be 2 billion, and so the population rate would plateau out. And then presumably start to fall as those higher blocks, the 20 to 40s, the 40 to 60s, 60 to 80, as those blocks then became older and died out, there would only be still be 2 billion children being produced. And so it would decrease the population over time. But that's 82 years' time. That's a long time to wait. And the population is going to get to 11 billion. Is that overpopulation? What are the other solutions? You can't do what India did. You can't do what China did. What can you do? Let's find out.
Beetroot Radio, community radio for Rushton and the Nen Valley. Find us online and on mobile.
Anyway, let's look at other solutions, because we can't do what we did in India, can't do what we did in China. Other solutions. Number 1, empower women. Yeah, studies show that women with access to reproductive health service find it easier to break out of poverty, while those who work are less likely to are more likely to use birth control. Promote family planning. Educating men and women about contraception has a big impact. Iran started, because Iran, you know, it's our enemy, because, you know, the US told us it was our enemy. Even though they haven't had a war for, I don't know, 200, 300 years, except when Iraq went in, supported by the United States. But Iran started a national family planning program in 1989 when its fertility rate was 5.6 births per woman, and now it's fallen to 2.6. Also provide a universal and access to safe and effective contraception options for both sexes. Government incentives. And we're talking incentives here. Create a senior government official position responsible for addressing population issues. This is the UK here. Have we got one? I don't think we have. Have we? I don't think we have. Do we not think this is important? Remember, it's the elephant in the room, the 400-pound gorilla. We must stop ignoring this and actually talk about it, get it out in the open to see if we can do something about it. We also should end all policies that reward parents financially based on the number of children we have. Now, OK, in the UK, there is a two-child benefit limit. I quote now from a government UK government website. You won't be paid an additional amount for more than two children unless the children are born before 6 April 2017 on or before 6 April for income support or if special circumstances apply. So they're not going to, you know, hurt people in poverty and stuff like this, but they are saying you have a lot of kids, you pay for them yourself. Well, you decide if that's a good thing. But here's a fun thing. I thought I'd throw this in. I don't know if you remember, there was a woman in America called Octomom. Her name was Natalie Denise Dowd Sullivan, also known as Octomom. And she became an American media personality because she became famous because she gave birth to octuplets in January 2009, which is all great. Oh, my God. Woman's given birth to eight. I think it was the, and they're still alive. I believe so, about 7 years old or something now. Wait a minute, 2009. Yeah, seven, eight, 9 years old. Still alive, so I believe. Problem was, it got a bit, public reaction wasn't very good once they realized that she already had six children, was unemployed, on welfare, public assistance, social security, if you want to call it that. And they were all conceived, the octuplets and her other six children, via in vitro fertilization, IVF, right? You decide how you feel about that. 14 kids, all by in vitro fertilization, and here we are talking about overpopulation. But at least she did some good things. She became bankrupt. Oh, she made some porn films, actually won an award, a porn award. Made a Bee Hover movie, and she stayed on the American welfare system. Okay, bit of fun. So what else can we do to solve population? We should adjust to an aging population instead of boosting childbearing through government incentives and programs. Obviously, we're going to provide good medical support and stuff like that. This is what this is saying. But kind of lean away from childbearing and lean towards the aging population that we have, that we know is that situation's going to get even more as medical science improves, as people have the opportunity to eat better, whatever, lead better lives in a country like the UK. That's where we should start to move our focus. We should guarantee education through secondary school for all, especially girls. And we're talking globally here now. Because there are a lot of girls that don't get educated. And because they don't get educated, then they don't get taught about family planning. They don't get jobs. And then they don't have that freedom to take control of their own reproduction. the world should offer age-appropriate sexual education for all students, and we should also eradicate gender bias from law, economic opportunity, health, and culture. All these things will change things. Whether they will provide the solution before we hit that 2100 figure of 11 billion, don't know. Now, I'm going to throw some conspiracy theory here because that's what I do. There's a thing which is kind of famous in the conspiracy theory world, and it's called Agenda 21. And there's also another agenda that's come out called Agenda 2030, and these are United Nations agendas. So United Nations Agenda 21, United Nations Agenda 2030, all about this thing called sustainability. And like everything that's a good idea, it can also be warped and used for bad things, right? This is, a lot of this is said about the, for example, something that you would consider as innocent as the World Wildlife Fund. And I'm not going to get into that because that would almost be a whole show. But get out on the web and have a look and see some of these theories. And they're not just theories. Because remember, who started a World Wildlife Fund? Prince Philip. Well, you can trust Prince Philip, of course. He's a member of our royal family, right? Of course. So, what UN Agenda 21 and 2030, if I summarize what it's about, remember, this is United Nations. It's about ending national sovereignty. Well, of course, one of the steps towards ending national sovereignty is to group countries together. That would be the EU, wouldn't it? Because that's what a lot of the people criticize the EU for. It's the first step towards global domination, the New World Order, right? But we ain't going to be part of that. We're going to be a little tiny island all on our own, and our only friend's going to be the United States because we love Donald Trump. It's all going to be fine. Okay, move on. So end national sovereignty. Centralization of control of all aspects of global life. This is agenda, UN, United Nations Agenda 21. Abolition of private property. Why? Because it's unsustainable. Creation of human settlement zones, sustainable cities. And you remember my statistic earlier on when I was talking about 80% of people living in urban areas. Obviously, that's going to head towards 100. Justify Agenda 21. Justified by global warming, climate disaster, pollution, water shortage, and so on. And this is part of what I'm saying, is you can use these things if you wanted to. If you were looking for that kind of global control, you could use these things to drive towards the fact that, oh, the only thing we can do is take control of everything and we'll take care of you. Don't you worry, little people. We'll take care of you. We'll take over global control and then we'll deal with global warming and we'll deal with climate disasters and we'll deal with pollution and we'll deal with this. Just give us the reins and we'll take it. Sign this piece of paper giving away all your civil and human rights. Yeah. Now, I got a couple of statements here from a guy called Maurice Strong, who was the Under Secretary General of United Nations. I think he was also Secretary General of an environmental group within the United Nations. But the interesting thing is, he's part of a group which is called the Club of Rome. Look it up online. Part of the group called the Club of Rome, which is kind of an offshoot of the Bilderberg Group, if you've heard me talk about that before. And it's a group of the super wealthy, super powerful, super this, who get together in, I'm not going to say secret, because people know they meet, but they don't know what they talk about. And who else would be members of the Club of Rome? Well, you remember those quotes I did earlier on? One from Bill Gates, Club of Rome. Ted Turner, Club of Rome. Prince Philip, Club of Rome. There you go. Is there something about this? But anyway, Maurice Strong said, quote, "It is clear that current lifestyles and consumption patterns of the affluent middle class involving high meat intake, consumption of large amounts of frozen and convenience foods, use of fossil fuels, appliances, home and workplace air conditioning and suburban housing are not sustainable." So what he's saying is your little house outside town that you've been saving and scraping for and all that kind of thing is unsustainable. You can't have it. You've got to come and live in the city in a tower block with everybody else. He also said, either we reduce the world's population voluntarily or nature will do this for us, but brutally. Now, the United Nations identified a fundamental cause of biodiversity loss as the unsustainable high rate of human population growth. And that's the United Nations. And of course, the United Nations, again, just like the EU, has been accused of being kind of part of the step towards global domination, the New World Order, all this stuff. It's scary, isn't it? Very, very scary indeed. I don't know. But anyway, that's kind of what I was talking about overpopulation. You decide. And again, remember what my purpose is here is to just let you think about these things, to bring things that you might not have known, like the China policy, that it wasn't quite as simple as banning everybody from having one child, although, again, it was a breach of human and civil rights. But just to make you aware of these things so you can think about them and make up your own mind, this is the thing. Are we going places we want to go? The government that we elected through our democratic process, are they doing what we elected them to do? Or are they being driven by some other forces, some deep state actors who are pulling their strings and making them do things that we don't want them to do? Because we seem to have a referendum on something like the EU, which I honestly think the government at the time absolutely messed up. I'm not saying it was a bad decision. Democracy, democracy, that's that. But the government, I think, didn't for a moment think that the country would vote to leave the EU. And they did, which basically said they've got a lot of issues. We have a lot of issues that we think are very strong and that we should leave the EU because of those issues. The government could have dealt with those issues because we weren't fully in the EU. We were a special group with our own sovereignty. We didn't have the euro. There were lots of other things where we didn't follow the rank and file of the EU. Nevertheless, we came out of the EU. So that's all part of that. I think it's a good thing because we're not part of that global sort of control, that global New World Order. But is it a good thing as far as our economy is concerned? What scares me, as you've heard me say before, is it does seem that the only friend we're going to have in the world, apart from the Commonwealth countries, is going to be the United States. And the United States have recently made it absolutely clear that you cannot rely on any agreement, trade agreement, support, any discretionary tariffs and things for allies and things like this. You absolutely can't rely on them. And they're all going to have left. Because the EU, we won't be part of the EU. They'll make their own rules and we'll be stuck with it. Well, we'll see. I hope it works out. I really do. Now, we are going to talk about Mars Organics. Yes. Now, Mars, I'm sure you know, is 4.6 billion years old. It is a tiny bit older than the Earth. But it's only half the diameter of the Earth. And I was surprised because I've always had this idea that Mars is kind of similar size to Earth. And that as far as the planets were concerned, it sort of went Mercury, Venus, Mars, Earth. But in fact, it's not. In ascending size. Actually, it's Mercury, Mars, Venus. because Venus is the planet that's a similar size, and I didn't realise that. Oh, and I should mention that next week I'm going to be talking about comets, meteorites and asteroids. Because when you speak to scientists and they talk about like an asteroid strike, okay, when you talk about an asteroid strike, they will say, well, it's not a question of will an asteroid strike the Earth, it's a question of when. And that we're going to talk about next week. So better tune into my show, 9 p.m. on Beetroot Radio, community radio for Rushton and the Nen Valley, with the Andy Wise Show. Now, as I said, Mars is 4.6 billion years old, half the diameter of the Earth, and it lost its magnetosphere about a billion years after its formation. Now, the magnetosphere is... the Earth has a strong magnetosphere, which is one of the things that protects us from the sun, protects us from solar winds, solar radiation and stuff like that. That, in combination with gravity, is what keeps our atmosphere in place, which is why we can breathe, which is why we've got clouds, which is why we've got this resistance. That's why, because we're messing it up now by putting lots of carbon dioxide out there, our atmosphere is creating this greenhouse effect. So when Mars lost its magnetosphere about a billion years after its formation, the solar winds came along and just stripped away its atmosphere. It does have an atmosphere now, but it's incredibly thin. Interesting thing is, life began on Earth with single-celled organisms about 700 million years after its formation. Now, Mars, if it cooled before the Earth, would have had a billion years to get to a position where it could start to develop life. And there was this event, and I think it was called the bombardment. Anyway, it was all about the asteroids. I think because Jupiter, which is absolutely massive, formed, and that threw the gravitational fields in the solar system into just uproar. So asteroids were flying around everywhere and bashing the heck out of the planets that have already formed. So that would have been Mercury, Venus, the Earth, and of course Mars. So bits could have come off of Mars and come to Earth that might have had microorganisms that actually developed on Mars. Or at least the chemicals of life. Very interesting. Could have come from Venus as well. Could have come from outer space. It's really interesting because the question remains is how did life start on this Earth? Because scientists used to believe that it started on Earth because there were some combination of elements, and they're not quite sure what, in combination with the electricity of lightning, which is like the Frankenstein thing where, you know, the lightning comes through the top of the roof and it's alive! It's alive, Igor! And really, you know, that was nonsense. It was rubbish. Because what they think now is that the life, or at least the, I still can't remember this name, the acids that were necessary to produce, I'm hoping it's dropping my head and it's not going to happen. The acids that were necessary to produce life came from outer space. That's basically what they're saying. But the thing is, in June 2018, so that's this month, right? NASA's Curiosity rover found new evidence preserved in rocks on Mars that suggests the planet could have supported ancient life, as well as new evidence that the Martian in the Martian atmosphere that relates to the search for current life on the red planet. They found what they called tough organic molecules, that is, organic molecules that could survive, perhaps, in space. Who knows? And they found it in sedimentary rocks, which are 3 billion years old. Well, if when all those asteroids, the heavy bombardment phase, that's what it was called, the heavy bombardment of the asteroids smashed the heck out of Mars, pieces would have flown off. One of those pieces could have had that stuff in it, maybe, which came to Earth. So we actually life started from something from Mars? Possible. Yep. Because they don't know what the real answer is, right? So they found tough organic molecules in 3 billion-year-old sedimentary rocks near the surface, as well as seasonal variations in the levels of methane in the atmosphere. And methane is an organic gas. We've got methane on our planet here. It's one of the problems that we've got because methane is a greenhouse gas, but it's organic. It's, oh, the places my mind goes. Methane, it's one of the things they blame. Actually, this is true. It's one of the things they blame on the greenhouse effect is the methane produced by cow farts. Yes, cow farts. I think last week or the week before I was talking about snake farts. Now I'm talking about cow farts. it's true. They said that, and I think there may be some fact actually attached to it, not to the cow farts, but to the whole meat production and the fact that we eat meat and we have these terrible factory farms and all this kind of thing like this is actually contributing to the greenhouse gases in the planet, which of course is causing climate change, global warming. Anyway, so that's just an interesting statistic, but it's real. That NASA's Curiosity found those organics. And it's so fascinating as they look out in space and they can find out more of these things. They say it's going to be 10 to 15 years time where they will be able to point an array of instruments at a planet. And because, you know, they found those planets that are in the Goldilocks zone, which is the not too hot, not too cold zones around stars or red dwarf stars or proper, you know, sun type stars. And they're not too hot, not too cold. They're now finding planets by using a whole array of instruments, telescopes, infrared telescopes, and spectrometers that actually analyze these things. Between all those things, they can determine the actual size. So they're finding planets that are generally a bit larger than us, but they're in the Goldilocks zone. They will also be able to point instruments at that planet and say what its atmosphere is. Well, if they find that atmosphere is, generally speaking, CO2, so there's carbon and there's oxygen, then those are the building blocks of life. Absolutely. So that's fascinating because they will just be able to point to it. I mean, something like in our galaxy, there are 500 million, just our Milky Way galaxy, there are 500 million planets that could be habitable by life as we know it. Does that make sense? Because there's billions of stars with planets revolving around them, and they estimate 500 million. And they also said that if they estimate about 0.5% of those could have environments that might support life as we know it. So 0.5% is a 200th. I don't know. Do the math. That would be 20,000. Something like that. Anyway, those kind of numbers. And that's just in our galaxy. And let's not forget, there are billions of galaxies out there in the universe, which kind of supports that there's got to be life out there. Got to be. Anyway, let's move on to the alien octopus. Did you know that octopi were the first intelligent beings on Earth? Absolutely. Octopus have actually got fantastic brains. But through the way they evolve, they've kind of stopped evolving their DNA, and they have evolved their RNA to give them more of these spectacular abilities that they've got, because there are octopi that can change color and can actually change texture to match the textures that's around them. So not only can they be the same color as the rock, they can be the same texture as the rock, so undetectable. So it's fascinating, isn't it? And so that was 100 million years before mammals came along and were intelligent. So the octopi were the first intelligent beings on the Earth. That this is assuming that we only had intelligent mammals about 170 million years ago, which was about the time that we're talking about human beings as distinct from... See, I'm not sure about the statistic, because I think Neanderthals were around then, maybe. Homo erectus, Homo heidelbergensis, Homo forensis, Homo devonensis, all those different ones. I would have thought they were intelligent. But anyway, that's a statistic I picked up. Did you know octopuses have 3 hearts, 9 brains, and blue blood? Yes, blue blood. So they would be able to escape from Prince Philip's virus. Radical new research has suggested that octopuses are aliens, which evolved on another planet before arriving on Earth hundreds of millions ago, years ago, as cryopreserved eggs via a process known as panspermia. Now, panspermia is this idea that we might have got biological material. Oh, I'm sorry, I'm still trying to think of those acids. Do you ever get that? When there's a fact or something that's just on the tip of your tongue, that's what we say, isn't it? And it just won't come. I bet you it'll come as soon as I finish the show. it's not going to come. The acids begin with A, I think. Never mind. I'm sorry. I'm boring you. Okay, so let's go on. So panspermia is this idea that life, or the elements that made up life, came from somewhere else. We've mentioned Venus. We've mentioned Mars. There are other planets in our solar system that might have life, like Europa, which is the moon of either Jupiter or Saturn. And Jupiter, I think, which is an ice ball. But it may have a hot core, or it may, because of the gravitational pull of Jupiter, which is stretching it and pushing it, it may be hot inside, so it may have water inside. But where there's water, there's a possibility of life. I think there's a meteorite, which is called Ceres, which I think is the biggest meteorite in the Kuiper Belt. I get confused here. No. The Kuiper Belt is the one that Pluto's part of, I think. It's the asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter, and Ceres is in there, and it's a big ice giant. And they think that those ice giants may have been the way that the water got to Earth, because they also don't know where the water that we've got, our oceans and our seas and rivers and so on, they don't know where that water came from, because Earth is a rock. So where did all that water come from? But anyway, these claims about the octopus and the cryopreserved eggs came from a report entitled The Cause of the Cambrian Explosion, because the Cambrian started about 500 million years ago, I think. And during that time, all kinds of species came up, including the dinosaurs. They say, could that be terrestrial or could it be cosmic? And it was 33 scientists, accredited scientists, peer-reviewed, published in the Progress of Biophysics and Molecular Biology journal. The paper suggests that the explanation for the sudden flourishing of life during the Cambrian era, which is also known as the Cambrian Explosion, is a result of the Earth being bombarded by clouds of organic molecules. Well, that would make sense, wouldn't it? One plausible explanation, this is a quote now, quote, "One plausible explanation in our view is that the new genes are likely new extraterrestrial imports to Earth, most plausibly as an already coherent group of functioning genes within, say, cryopreserved and matrix-protected fertilized octopus eggs." The skinny on that layman's language is those eggs were frozen somehow, and let's say they came from the meteorite Ceres. They came down in a ball of ice, came down onto Earth. Earth had already got water on it. They melted. The eggs were still viable. They hatched out, and that's how the octopi got on this Earth. Absolutely extraordinary. Yeah, it's amazing. And because we, again, the scientists don't know how life got on this Earth. Well, the idea that other life may have come on later after life had already started, like 3 billion years ago on Earth and was evolving. Maybe other life came from extraterrestrial sources, and then that life started evolving. So we may even find that different streams of life, different species or whatever on our planet, actually came from different sources. They weren't all evolved from the start. And then you've got to ask the question, well, is that what happened to man? Maybe. It's interesting, though, isn't it? Isn't it fascinating? They also said, thus, the possibility that cryopreserved squid and or octopus eggs arrived in icy bolides several hundred million years ago, it should not be discounted, as that would be a parsimonious cosmic explanation for the octopus sudden emergence on the Earth circa 270 years ago. Now, this is a bit dodgy because there are no fossils of octopuses because there's no hard bits. There's no bones. There's nothing to turn to stone as it would if it was a Brontosaurus, though I don't think Brontosaurus has existed. They were, they've got a different name now. But one of those prehistoric animals, right, that we see displayed in the Natural History Museum, they're made of stone, but it's bone that's turned to stone. But an octopus has just got a beak. That's the only hard bit on an octopus. That's why they survive so well. That's one of their properties that make them such a successful species, because there's octopus all over the place in the world. It's quite amazing, quite astonishing. So I find that interesting. And of course, there is that relationship to man, because there's various theories about how man got on the Earth. There's the one about the Anunnaki who came to the Earth in millions of years ago, but they were the ones that created the big sweep of civilization that happened at the end of the Ice Age in the Fertile Crescent of kind of Egypt, Israel, Lebanon, Sumeria, Babylon, around that area, that was actually created by some alien race coming in, messing about with our genetics. Well, we're kind of seeing through the DNA projects that have been done that a lot of that actually follows through as a straight line. And there's some fascinating programs out there on YouTube looking at the DNA of human beings, and they actually keep finding more things. They found the DNA of these human beings called Denisovans. And they called them Denisovans because they found their traces in the a cave nearby a town called Denisova, I suppose. So they called them Denisovans. But the interesting thing is they didn't know they were there or how they fitted in with things until they did the DNA tests around the world. And what they were basically looking for was, did the human, Homo sapien, ever kind of cohabit, reproduce with Neanderthals? And then when they looked for that, they found this, what they called Woman X, because there was like this new line in there. And they're like, what is this? And they were actually Denisovans. And they tended to be the ones that traveled right over to Eastern Asia. And then possibly down, I think, into Australia. So the Aboriginals, I think. Probably need to check that out. But certainly there are islands out there in the Pacific that there's a deal of Denisovan DNA in their DNA, which is very, very interesting, fascinating. And one of the things I found interesting, I watched the movie Arrival, if you've ever seen that. It was kind of an interesting movie, presented some interesting questions and stuff like that. It's quite well made. And that portrayed the Martians as some kind of cephalopod. I won't say too much in case you haven't seen the movie, but yes, they did, as some kind of cephalopod, which of course is the, is it species or the genus of octopi, squids and so on. And this is Andy Y on the Andy Y Show on Beetroot Radio, community radio for Rushton and the Nen Valley. And once again, it's been my pleasure to provide you with some information, hopefully tell you some things you didn't know. because I like doing this research and analysis. I like putting these things together. The trouble is, every time I get to one of these subjects, it's like opening Pandora's box. It just opens endlessly before me, and I try to stay on track. It's really tough. And then I'm fiddling around with the tech here. This isn't much tech for these DJs and everything. They're all experts at it. Beatroot Radio's got some great people. But me, it's challenging. By the way, you know that thing I was trying to remember? Amino acids. I just had to look it up online. What an idiot. Anyway, hopefully I've opened that little door in your mind somewhere and allowed some of this stuff to go in just for consideration. It's up to you to make up your mind, but hopefully I've given you some ideas and some more information. Next week, we're going to be talking about comets, asteroids, meteorites. As I said, the scientists say it's not a matter of will it hit the Earth, it's a matter of when. And so we'll talk about that whole idea of what happens with that. What are asteroids? What are comets? What are meteors? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I've already done a whole chunk of stuff on this. So that's really good. So it's been my pleasure talking to you. I will be talking again next week at 9 p.m. Saturday. Be there or be square. And I hope you have a great rest of the weekend. Let's